This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we have a journalistic 1013 in Oakland, California, a reporter down. A correspondent for KPFA Pacifica's Flashpoints program was assaulted and arrested overnight by federal local authorities and an anti-pot SWAT squad. We'll speak live with Flashpoints executive producer Dennis Bernstein about the latest status of correspondent Jose Gutierrez. We also revisit Haiti today, where there are unprecedented historical levels of cholera brought there by occupation troops from the United Nations. We'll be speaking with Brian Concannon about the latest situation in Haiti. We will move then from the land of Creole to the land of Seminole County, Florida, where we will continue our analysis of the Trayvon Martin case with Shelton Marshall of the Black Law Students Association of Florida A&M University. And then Michael Clare speaks about the coming energy crisis and depletion, not only of oil, but other resources that could turn the United States into an economic third world nation when it comes to energy. All of that and more coming up on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Today on Flashpoints, federal agents swooped down this morning on Oakland's Amsterdam University, the state's first cannabis industry training school. Flashpoints special correspondent Jose Gutierrez was beaten down and arrested right after he spoke with us from the tent scene earlier today. We'll play his report before the arrest and speak with his partner, who is still trying to find out where the hell he is and how he's been treated. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
What is our bad power?
It was one of the.
What is our bad power?
Okay, standing up. He's the one who shot me.
You're listening to a malaise that happened earlier today in front of the Amsterdam University, Cannabis University. This was actually happening at the attached dispensary. Our broadcaster, our special correspondent, Jose Alarcón Gutierrez, was doing some pretty good reporting. We spoke with him, and then, after we said goodbye, he was about to call us back. He got taken down very hard by the feds for no good reason other than he was being a journalist, roughed up very bad, and then taken away somewhere. We're still trying to figure out where he was taken. So that's the malaise out front as the feds come in and raise hell in Oakland.
And that is an excerpt from the opening of the overnight edition of Flashpoints, our sibling program produced by our broadcast colleague Dennis Bernstein, executive producer of the series Flashpoints, originating at Pacifica Station KPFA. We are now joined live by Dennis Bernstein, and we heard the tip of the iceberg overnight about the arrest of our, or one of your reporters, in a federally augmented raid on a university that teaches about drug education. First, Dennis, welcome back to 5 O'Clock Shadow. And what is the latest status that we have on your correspondent, Jose Gutierrez?
Well, we were in, thanks, Robert. Good to be back on the Shadow. We were in federal court this morning. Our good brother and friend and community reporter, Jose Alarcón Gutierrez, a special correspondent for Flashpoints, was out yesterday to witness and report on and protest. He was an advocate journalist. The federal raid on essentially the core of the new marijuana community industry called Amsterdam University. They have an associated dispensary. Medical marijuana is legal in California based on people's decision. But the feds decided for some reason, and we're talking about a lot of them, we're talking about DEA agents, U.S. Marshals, IRS agents, descended, heavily armed, on this quiet street, in relatively quiet street in Oakland, and went after everything they...
But wait a minute, Dennis. Yeah. I'm under the impression that President Obama and his administration said that they would be laying hands off on locally enacted medical marijuana processes.
Well, he might want to talk to the frontline DEA agents and federal marshals who showed up by the dozens yesterday. That is really... He said he was going to do hands off, you know, and, you know, when Alabama passed all that racist anti-immigrant law, the attorney general said, well, you know, we're just going to watch it closely, but, you know, this is sort of a local states' rights thing. I'm not sure what they're doing in marijuana Oakland, but in any event, our special correspondent for Flashpoints, Jose Gutierrez, was in the middle of it reporting. He gave us his first report on the when they went after the sort of the classroom center, the training center. And then he was supposed to get right back to us because the feds had gone after the dispensary. In the middle of that, there was some malaise. And apparently, he was, not apparently, you could see it on YouTube. You could see there are various, if the feds don't keep taking it down, you could see Jose being taken down by 10 very heavily armed federal agents and really being done in. He may have broken a rib. We don't know. We were in federal court this morning. I do believe he's being released. And I want to be very clear, Robert.
What are the charges, Dennis?
Well, resisting arrest and assault, I believe, at this point. I haven't seen the paperwork, but that's our understanding at this point. And again, it's very important for me to be clear, Robert, that Jose, if Jose Gutierrez, Jose Alarcon Gutierrez, is definitely working with Flashpoints and La Onda Bajita, that's a Friday night show with Miguel Gavila Molina, who works on both shows. He's an expert on the whole medicinal marijuana movement, and he's an advocate and an advocate reporter working for Flashpoints. There was some confusion because after they jumped him and apparently beat the hell out of him, you know, people will make that visual available. And they dragged him up. When he was leaving, people were yelling at him, "Who are you? Where are you?" And I believe he may have identified or misidentified himself as a KPFA news reporter, but he meant he was reporting for community broadcasting KPFA.
Well, he was corresponding for a public affairs program on KPFA.
Exactly. And so if there's any confusion about that, we want to clear that up. We want people to know that he's an expert in this arena of medicinal marijuana, and he's a very fine, courageous, frontline correspondent / protest.
Well, we'll keep following that, Dennis. I thank you for coming on live with the latest on that, and I'm sure you'll have new details by the time that your show, Flashpoints, goes online at 5 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time at flashpoints.net and also at kpfa.org. Dennis will be keeping an eye on the situation, and thank you for your frontline breaking update on this.
You're welcome, and thanks, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Coming up, Brian Concannon with the United Nations instigated cholera epidemic in Haiti. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we go now to the situation in Haiti, where an amazing more than 7,000 Haitians are reported to have recently died due to an outbreak of a relatively unprecedented disease in that island, semi-island nation. And that's about 5% of the officially recorded population. Word is that the cholera outbreak became manifest through unsanitary river dumping by the military troops, the United Nations Occupation Force in Haiti. Joining us now is Brian Concannon to bring us up to date on the latest. This sounds like a latter-day world event. Never has there been this much cholera in Haiti, has there?
Right before the UN came in, there was never cholera in Haiti. It's actually fairly rare in the Western Hemisphere of a country that has no reported incidence of cholera. But once it hit in October of 2010, it spread like wildfire and it's throughout the country.
What was the origin of it?
The origin were peacekeeping troops that were rotated in October of 2010 who came from a country where there's a cholera epidemic. They were not tested for cholera before coming to Haiti, and the sewage disposal, the human waste disposal at their base led to direct contamination of Haiti's largest river system in two places.
We're talking about the infection of 1 out of 20 Haitians with this. Is there any kind of infrastructure or medical network to adequately deal with this in Haiti in the wake of the hurricane, the flooding, the landslides and disasters?
Well, most people think that everybody agrees that the official numbers of 1 in 20 Haitians being infected and 7,000 dead are an undercount. It's probably about half of the real numbers. We're probably talking about 1 million people sick and 15 or so thousand people dead. And because most of the people are so far off the grid and so far away from medical treatment that they received nothing and were never even recorded, there certainly was not an adequate response to the epidemic, and still isn't. There's been a lot of individual efforts, and some organizations have done great jobs. The Cuban doctors, Partners in Health, Doctors Without Borders have really put in quite a few treatment centers, and that reduced the rate of death from infections, but there still is a lot of people who are not getting adequate treatment. But more important is people are just keep getting sick. And as long as cholera is in the water system, and it's very persistent, and as long as Haitians don't have adequate sanitation and clean water programs, people will continue to get sick and die. The cholera epidemic is currently the world's worst. Here we are 15 months after it started, and it's still the world's worst epidemic.
What kind of culpability has the United Nations admitted for this? What kind of reparations is this world body paying? And what happened to the money that Bill Clinton promoted for Haiti?
Right now, no cholera victims have been compensated by the United Nations. The UN has provided some clean water systems, but nothing near systematic, and has been part of the medical response. But there's been no reparations or any compensation paid directly to the victims. What our clients are asking for is three things. They want the UN to put in the clean water systems that are necessary to control the epidemic. Second, they want reparations for their damages. And third, they want an apology. And so far, none of those are forthcoming. In terms of what else the UN is spending money on, it's interesting that the estimated price tag for providing the water projects necessary to control the epidemic is $700 million to $1.2 billion. The budget of MINUSTA, the peacekeeping force, is about $800 million a year. That's $2.4 million every single day for an organization that has 1 in 10 UN peacekeepers in a country that has not had recognized war in any of our lifetimes.
What is the pragmatic effect of the United Nations military occupation in Haiti relative to politics, democracy, and populism?
It certainly hasn't been supportive of democracy. The stated justification is to try to keep basic peace and to fight crime, which they've been doing some of that, and there's some value in that in terms of keeping peace in Haiti. But the UN has also done things like repressing legal demonstrations, taking the sides of the police when they're doing illegal attacks. Back in 2004 to 2006, there were outright UN attacks on very murderous UN attacks on popular neighborhoods that supported progressive politics. And more recently, Haiti had a president that was installed last year. He actually won the vote of about 18% of Haitian voters, but he got, more important, the endorsement of the UN and Secretary of State Clinton, and that really got him into the presidency. And he's a far-right politician. He actually had no political experience, but he comes from the far right of the spectrum, and certainly not what he had the right to run, but he's not the type of person that the Haitian people would have elected in a fair election. But the UN, combined with the previous administration and the U.S., made sure that the Haitian people were not given that choice, because the former ruling party kept the Lavalas party out of the elections, and the UN and the U.S. Endorsed that measure. And just from perspective, the Lavalas party has won every election it has ever contested by a landslide. There's always a controversy, but it's a controversy about the extent of the landslide, not the fact of it. And so this was like having an election in the U.S. where you don't let the Democrat and the Republican party run and then see who wins. And that basically happened in Haiti under the UN's watchful eye.
The political organization that comes out of the legacy of the Aristide presidency, is that moribund or militant or bubbling under the surface at this point in time?
Well, coup d'etats and political repression and the killing and jailing of top party leaders work. And as a result of that, and also co-opting, there's been a lot of buying off of Lavalas leaders. As a result, it is an organization without strong leadership, but support of... It's hard to guess exactly, but it's between 60% and 80% of the Haitian electorate. Very solid support. And so if there were a presidential election today, there's no question that whoever the candidate of the Lavalas party was would win. And that's despite having very serious structural weaknesses in the party that are some a result of the party's own doing, but also mostly the result of years of repression.
Well, Brian Concannon, thank you so much for being with us today. I know you work with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Tell us about that work and how people can be aware of or perhaps take part in it.
Sure. The best place is to come to our website, which is HaitiJustice.org, and we have a lot of ways of getting people involved. We have action alerts. We need financial assistance. We have a website to keep people up to date on what's going on here. And so we encourage people to come to our website and try to join this movement.
Well, thank you so much for joining us while in transit, as is acoustically apparent. And we've been speaking with Brian Concannon of the Institute for Justice and Democracy and Development in Haiti, IJDH.org. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll be back with more after this.
The earth cracked open from its core, a quarter million dead, or maybe more.
Lenin and O'Brien in a late night war. For 40 million bucks, Conan's out the door.
2 million homeless dying in the street, with nothing left to drink or eat.
So many stars at the Golden Globes, wearing their diamonds and their fancy clothes.
There's some big disaster way out there. At the airport won't let through.
the doctor's food or medicine. What can we do?
Chinese or Italian, where to eat? With so many choices right down our street.
Obama brings in Bush for Haiti's rescue plan. New Orleans destroyed under his command.
Tiger Woods, he's addicted to sex. Will his wife soon become his ex?
There's some big disaster way out there. I haven't heard much lately. I can recall we used to care about a place called Haiti.
American Idol season 9. I miss Paula, but Ellen will be fine.
Like genocide, without food or water, many more will die.
Avatar is flying high. The 3D was so good, it made me cry.
Useless information clogs our brains, it blinds our eyes.
Some big disaster way out there. I haven't heard much lately. Now I can recall we used to care about a place called Haiti.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we're now joined by Michael T. Clare, who has just completed a remarkable work about the prospect of the United States entering the economic level of inability of the rest of the world when it comes to future energy and mineral resources. Welcome, Michael.
Hi.
Tell us about your new book.
Okay. Well, my new book, it's called The Race for What's Left. And it describes what I think is a final stage of humanity's historic struggle to absorb, to extract the Earth's natural resources. And when this stage is over, we better have some plan B in place, because we're running out of most of the things we rely on, energy, minerals, and a lot of other things. And in this final stage, you know, we're going to the edge of the Earth, to the Arctic, the deep oceans, to Mongolia and Tibet and a few other places that still have resources to supply us, and to enter rock formations in this country that were inaccessible in the past, that we're now invading with very aggressive technology like hydrofracking.
So much of the national energy budget is in fossil fuels, whether it be coal or petroleum. And we're seeing a global manipulation of the energy market, a rise in prices. And as you point out in your articles and book about this, some degree of opportunistic manipulation, would it be fair to say, by the oil monopolies?
A lot is going on. And in my mind, what the oil companies are trying most to do is to perpetuate our dependence on oil. That they know, they understand that there is a counter-trend taking place in parts of the world towards moving away from oil, towards alternative sources of energy, solar power, wind power, and other alternatives. And they're determined to try to prevent that for as long as they possibly can by by putting all kinds of obstacles in the way of alternative energy, and by using all kinds of propaganda and so on, and by maintaining our addiction in every way they possibly can to fossil fuels.
In the book, you make a very interesting picture of how historically the extraction of fossil fuels has relied on military ability to intervene in foreign countries that are blessed with oil, and the relatively easy extraction under those unregulated circumstances abroad. You further make the point that as this becomes more difficult, unstable, and as supplies may be diminishing despite claims of major oil finds every now and then, you say that there's been a retrenchment in the American petroleum industry, and the chickens are pretty much coming home to roost, as it were. And domestic drilling, and now we're seeing this water-threatening hydrofracking syndrome, offshore drilling, and reckless rigging leading to events like the BP oil spill and such. So can you elaborate, please, on what it means for there to be, on the one hand, a petro-based military foreign policy, and on the other hand, an economic a shrinkage or ingrowth?
Well, you did a good job of painting the broad strokes of the picture. The oil companies have long rested their business model is on selling oil and now natural gas to consumers in the United States. Now, for a long time, the United States was the world's leading producer of oil well into the 1950s. Then wells in this country, in Oklahoma and Texas and Louisiana and so on, kind of ran out. We reached peak oil in the United States in 1970. So they went abroad. They went especially to the third world, to Latin America, Venezuela, Mexico, and to Africa, and especially to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia. And in many cases, that required the use of military force to subdue opposition to the exploitation of those resources by U.S. oil companies and other international oil companies, BP and Shell. But now the third world isn't what it used to be. Many of those countries have nationalized their oil. People like Hugo Chavez in Venezuela has imposed state control over a lot of the oil in Venezuela, and the same thing is happening in most of the rest of the world, and they're tightening up their environmental regulations as well. So the oil companies see no choice but to come back to the USA. But as we've said, the easy oil in the U.S. is now gone. So the only way they can make a profit here, they can extract oil, is to invade oil formations that were inaccessible in the past, in shale rock or tar sands in Canada. And this requires rolling back all kinds of environmental regulations. So they kind of have to turn the U.S. into what the third world used to be.
Mm. Even more alarming, perhaps less prominent than the central focus on petroleum, Michael T. Clare, is the other point that you make, one I don't hear discussed as often or with such precision. And just as you referred, I was about to ask you about peak oil, that thesis that as drilling and extracting becomes more expensive, more resource intensive, that there will be alterations in policy and consumption. You also paint a picture of the equally alarming peak mineral crisis on the planet. What are these minerals? What are they needed for? And what's happening to them? And why are they not as accessible?
Okay, well, many minerals, it's a lot like oil. We depend on a whole range of minerals, from common industrial things like copper and iron, cobalt and nickel, to more obscure things like columbite and tantalum, molybdenum, lithium. We need those more obscure things for all the high technology devices we use, laptops, computers, hybrid cars, and advanced military systems as well. Now, we've been searching for these things and consuming these things for a very long time, just as we have in the case of oil. And just as is true of oil, we've used up all of the easy stuff, all of the large deposits like copper was once at great abundance in Chile, but most of Chile's large copper mines are now depleted. So we have to go to increasingly remote places to find what's left of the world's copper. Afghanistan has a giant copper mine, which is guarded by U.S.-trained Afghan troops, but it's a Chinese company that's going to produce that. And they're going to get iron now from the northernmost part of Canada, far beyond the Arctic Circle, and in Greenland, because just like with oil, everything that's easy to get is now gone.
We're speaking with Michael T. Clare. He's the author of a comprehensive new book called The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, and also of a new essay called New Energy, Third World in North America. Now, Michael, the question that awaits us is, what are the intelligent institutional responses, if any, to this crisis? I'm watching the assertion of the need for more offshore drilling from the Barack Obama administration. I'm aghast as I listen to the president and others claiming that nuclear energy is safe, clean, green energy and not a contributor to the greenhouse gas syndrome, even though it doesn't measure all of the steps in the fuel generation cycle and the mining and so on, and concrete and construction. So what is your assessment then of the national Obama administration policy for energy?
Obama, you know, basically he's embraced a strategy of, you know, let's go for everything. Let's please the Democrats. Let's please the Republicans. We'll please the Democrats and by promoting green energy. We'll please the Republicans by drilling in as many places as possible. Now, you know, maybe that's a good electoral strategy. I don't know. I don't think it's a viable strategy for the long run, but that's what he's doing. What I see is that there will be a struggle in this country and around the world between the new energy systems, many of them being developed in Silicon Valley, you know, coming out of the new wealth from the high-tech industry around alternative energy supplies, on one hand, and on the other hand, the old energy companies, coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear power, trying to keep us stuck in the past to keep our addiction to the old energy as long as they possibly can. And they're going to bring enormous weapons to bear. They're going to turn this election in 2012 into a contest between the old energy and the new energy as much as they possibly can. So this is going to be a very bitter fight that we're going to be immersed in this country for quite some time to come.
Michael Clare, I don't know if you have contemplated this in this way. There is a glut of technology that is dependent, of course, upon the minerals to which you refer, the semiconductors and new technology. Someone once said that if they were a character in 1984, that cell phones would be mandatory in order for everybody to be tracked every instant, every place that they go. And we're seeing a mushroom-like explosion of technology that is subsidized with loss leaders so that you indenture yourself into a cell phone or a tablet or a multimedia or a cable or a satellite contract for years to come. And if there is this shortage or this imminent shortage of the materials needed to maintain this technotronic system, do you anticipate that there would be any demographic changes in terms of rich and poor access to information and technology as a result of this energy crunch that is upon us?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think it's you phrase it very well, and it's something we have to think about. I certainly think that there will be divisions between those who can afford a lot of things and those who can't. I mean, I think that oil will become a luxury item in the not-too-distant future, that only the rich and the upper-middle class will be able to own cars, or oil-driven cars anyway, And you may well be right that other items will become unaffordable for many people because of the rising price of materials. That's a good point. Let me make clear, though, that we're not exactly running out of things in absolute terms. There's a lot of materials left in the world, but they're not easily obtainable. They have to be prized out of the earth using aggressive force, like hydrofracking or drilling deep, deep down into the earth. Of course, that takes energy, so the price of doing that will rise. But they also involve intense environmental risk. So to maintain the standard of living we've become accustomed to, we're going to see an exponentially greater environmental harm and risk. And that's the question that we're going to have to ask. How much environmental risk do we want to live with in order to maintain our standard of living?
I like what you allude to, brute force technology, the energy budget of the energy budget. We're speaking with Michael T. Clare, the author of the new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. Michael, tell us about this publication. Who is presenting it, and what has the response been so far?
Oh, well, thank you. This is my book is published by Metropolitan Books in New York City. The publisher is in the iconic Flatiron Building, I'm always happy to say, because I love the building and I love New York City, and so I'll put that out there. And the response, you know, people, I'm finding that people are becoming increasingly politicized around the issue of energy. There are those people who think that this is the time to move towards green energy, and that my book makes a strong case for that, and other changes in lifestyle. And there are plenty of those people, when I get on national talk shows, who say that, you know, we should do anything that it takes to maintain the way things are. If it means drilling in Anwar and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, let's do it. If it means tar sands from Canada, let's do it. So I sense that we're becoming politicized and polarized around these issues.
Michael Clare, you also have written a piece, The New Energy Third World in North America, how the big energy companies plan to turn the U.S. into the third world petrostate. Where might people read that, and what is the key thesis?
Now, this is published by tomdispatch.com, and people could see it there, or at alternet.org, salon.com. Many places have published that essay, and my thesis is quite simple, that when the oil companies and the mining companies used up the easily accessible oil and minerals in the United States and Canada, they moved to what used to be called the third world, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East, because there were more resources there and because there was a very lax environment around the environment, around taxation. Governments were corrupt, so you could go in, you could extract the energy, you didn't have to worry about labor laws, occupational hazards, any of that stuff. You just pay bribes and you could extract everything and make a lot of money. But now that the third world is not the third world anymore, they're coming back to the U.S. and they want to turn us into a third world country and roll back our environmental laws and our other protections so that they can extract more energy from this country.
Well, Michael, perhaps the equity that might come from the distress reminds me of my understanding. I know the sense in which you're using the term. But for me, the third world was always Earth. First Mercury, then Venus, then Earth. I thank you for your contribution to bringing sense to the global energy complex with your new book, The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources, written by Michael T. Clare, our guest here live today. Thank you, Michael.
My pleasure.
Good, me too. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and we move now to Florida, where we are rejoined today by Shelton Marshall of the Black Law Students Association of Florida A&M University, which has been one of the key intellectual, informational, and politically mobilizing forces in the tragic case of Trayvon Martin. Welcome back, Shelton. Let's just begin
with... Thank you.
Well, let's just begin. You have the floor, sir. What are the most significant developments over the past year or two that you think are worth noting?
Well, as you know, this case, something's new happening every day. And the main thing is because something is happening new each day, we have to adapt our movement and our response to the issue at the topic or issue at hand. I think one of the main issues that people are noting currently is that the issue of the state attorney being present on site the night of the killing and giving the command to release Zimmerman.
In the police station.
Yes.
Yes.
I apologize, yeah, for them to release Zimmerman. And I don't know if I mentioned this last time when I was on. I had the opportunity of actually speaking with the assistant state attorney that day that we actually did our rally from the courthouse, myself, Jasmine Rand, Jason Reed, and S.A. Igodoso. And that day, he explained how there was not adequate evidence to arrest him at that point in time, and that the Sanford Police Department had done a reasonable investigation, but it needs to be heavily supplemented before they can formulate charges due to Zimmerman having a viable self-defense claim. Well, we were perplexed by him asserting the self-defense claim rather than asserting the need to prosecute because he is a state attorney. Well, approximately two days after that meeting, which was on Monday, Norman Wolfinger resigned. And then they brought in the special state attorney from Tallahassee to come down and handle the matter. During this entire period, they were still blaming the Sanford Police Department for not doing a proper investigation. Sanford Police Department was responsible for this. They wanted to blame everything on Bill Lee. And now, after this information, the burden shifts back off of the Sanford Police Department now to the state attorney's office, who gave the go-ahead to release Zimmerman.
There was the remarkable statement by one of the homicide investigators that there was probable cause and reason for arrest, and so now the story is getting deeper about the intervention at higher levels with the district attorneys, the prosecutors. And I've got to ask you this, Shelton Marshall, do you think that one of the factors could have been the fact that George Zimmerman is, in fact, a son of a judge?
That's been all the talk and rage around here. We understand how officials can have influence and how their influence can transcend not just their current office, but the offices of the area in which they reside. And in addition to that, we know how people can exercise their authority and discretion to, remedy matters, or make certain matters not necessarily known to the public.
Make it go away, I think, is the expression.
Uh-huh. And as you know, Zimmerman was arrested twice, two felony arrests, but no convictions. First felony arrest was for resisting arrest with violence, and the second one was for felony assault upon a police officer. Two felony arrests, no convictions. And, you know, come on. I mean, I know that we're in a society where we do have, first offender programs, and we have deferment programs and things of that nature as far as, like, not going directly into prison or being brought up on charges. But after two felony arrests, and you're telling me you had no jail time, no fine, only thing happened was a slap on the hand, and you were given, like, anger management courses?
There's the idea of the law, and I know that you and your colleagues at Florida A&M, and especially with the Black Law Students Association, that you are proceeding on seeking redress or reversal of the so-called stand your ground law, which is pretty much a get out of jail free card for the right kind of people. And I'm, since we last spoke, we've discussed the surly, surreptitious national mobilization through the Heritage Foundation spinoff, ALEC, the American Legislative Executive Council, which in not only your state of Florida, Shelton, but as you are no doubt aware, has this on the burners in two dozen states, nearly half of the United States of America, now has cut and paste versions of this same law as in Florida. So today I ask you, are you on the verge of a national breakthrough in regard to this insidious legal process of exculpation for gun owners and those privileged in this society?
Well, yes, that's the next portion of the movement. It's not just about rallying. It's not about just wearing hoodies and bringing packs of Skittles. Now it's about making your voice heard through legislation. And a part of that is attacking this thing, your ground law, which is not even applicable in this case, mind you, but attacking this idea that one may kill another and be immune from prosecution or charge without having to go before a jury.
Or even serious questioning.
Yes, that's completely, and this completely rids any type of proper investigation. It completely, there's investigation. You keep your gun, you keep on your clothes after you shot someone. Like, what in the world? In what world are we living in?
Shelton, they might as well call it the oops law.
You know, they said they call it the Wild Wild West law. They call it the, you know, any type of, I don't know, I just don't understand what world we live in. Even if I felt personally that I was in fear for my life and I was in awe and I had the right to defend myself with a weapon such as a gun, I would be there. I would go through questioning. I would have to be charged for killing a person. Regardless of his self-defense, I will have to be charged for that, and I complete self-defense, and the jury decides whether or not I was in the right to defend myself. That's just the process. It has never been anything different. But all of a sudden, in this instance, it's something that we have to supposedly take as being the way of that has always been done, and it has not. Anyone can claim self-defense.
We're speaking with Shelton Marshall of BALSA, the Black Law Students Association at Florida A&M University. And I'd like to just broaden this for a question for you as a legal scholar and as a member of an association of African-American law majors, and that is this. We have a remarkably perfect storm in the case of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, in which, well, let's say it plain. The white guy is a double offender, at least that much. And the black victim, remarkably, almost statistically impossibly, is a young black man without a police record. Mm-hmm. A 3.5 grade point average student. Someone who, when some white supremacist group hacked his emails, find out that most of the messages are about the colleges he's been applying to and accepted to and choosing which ones to go for. This is so contrary to what the Obama administration did in California yesterday, to what is taking place in New York City with Stop and Frisk, what is taking place with every police department in this country, where young men are rounded up, Polaroided, or digitized. I believe there's a statistic that by the age of 40, 3/4 of all black men in America have been involved in the legal system in the United States. In other words, they've been tagged and bagged by a rights-violating search and seize and document process that is ubiquitous across the United States. Has your organization done work, or is it contemplating work, to reverse this fugitive slave syndrome that is afoot?
I mean, that's a part of the purpose in itself of being an educated African-American, because it's a privilege. And I stated this once before, the position I'm in is I'm not here on my own efforts. I'm here due to the sacrifice of those who came before me to be here. And it's a duty and a privilege to advocate on behalf of those who cannot advocate for themselves. And in this instance, we have to take a stance, not just the college students, but as a future attorney of tomorrow, I need to be in a place to make sure that people know that this is not the norm. We will not, and that we will not be treated like animals or less than human beings. We have a perspective, and that perspective should be valued. And when you value anyone in our community, you can learn how to value everyone in the world. And that's the only thing we're calling, even in this one instance, we're just calling for justice as far as the legal system is concerned. We just want a proper arrest and a trial by jury. That's the only, that's the basis of what we want. And that can go to anyone who had a child who was killed. Aside from any racial factors, we just want the fair distribution of justice in our community. And as you said, as we expound past this one issue, there's other issues as far as the ignorance of society towards our people, particularly our African-American men. And it's, I believe, my duty to stand in the place of those individuals and say that, no, this is not the norm. No, we will not be treated like this because we are not what you think we are. We are more than what you see on a rap video. We're more than what you perceive us walking down the street in a hoodie. You know, learn to reach out and understand the differences in the culture rather than seek to isolate them and consider them less than human beings because you can't empathize or understand what their perspective is.
It could not have been said better, sir. Thank you so much. Shelton Marshall of the Black Law Students Association at Florida A&M University. How can people keep up with and even help your work?
Yes, you can reach out to us at on Facebook. We have a Facebook group called Justice for Trayvon. It is where I post a lot of the up-to-date information pertaining to the case. As I get it, I put it out. It is about a lot of information about the Central Florida area and a lot of movements that we're doing here. I'm also recently become the National Director of Social Action for the National Black Law Student Association. So we will also be sending out feeds through NABLSA, which is www.nblsa.org. You can click on the links and find out more about the national organization and how to take part in our call to action. In the event that you'd like to email myself locally at our chapter to find out what's going on, you can email us at famu@nblsa.org. with any questions or concerns about anything that's upcoming. And if you're in the area and want to know what we're doing locally, just email, or you can even reach me on Facebook. I don't mind. But we just want to make sure that people know that this is not an isolated rally or just one incident. It's a movement that will transcend just marching, but it will go to voting, making sure everyone's registered to vote, contacting legislators, petitions, and making sure that we convert the image of African Americans in this society.
Well, thank you, Shelton Marshall, Esquire, Counselor to be.
Thank you, sir.
We'll stay in touch. This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and we'd like to give special acknowledgement today for extraordinary production by Thiago Rosso and extraordinary engineering by Michael G. Haskins, who is also our director of essential music here on 5 o'clock Shadow. And we welcome your comments, tips, queries, suggestions, etc. at TheShadow, TheShadow, TheShadow at WBAI.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.